You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Philip Meyer's latest novel, The Son, follows three members of different generations in a powerful and ambitious Texas family. It's a portrait of vulnerability, greed, brutality, and familial relationships. And Mr. Meyer's previous novel, American Rust, was named one of the best books of the year by The Washington Post, The New York Times, and The Economist. It earned a spot on Newsweek's list of best books ever. Publishers Weekly has called this new one the stuff of great American literature. Philip Meyer was here to talk about his latest novel last May, and we're re-airing that conversation for you today as we start the long holiday weekend. I began our conversation by noting that he'd worked on Wall Street, and I asked him, were you writing American Rust when you were working there?
No, I was writing my second unpublished, my second failed novel, so the second kind of apprentice book.
So how many novels that are now sitting in drawers somewhere did you write before you came up with American Rust?
Two. Yeah. I think that's about normal. At the time, it was quite frustrating, of course.
But that was just a way of paying the rent?
No, that was the Wall Street job, right, was a way of paying the rent, paying off my student loans. And the writing, I thought, of course, how hard could this really be? I quit this Wall Street job, I'll become a literary author. And my life won't change that much. But, of course, what happened was I ran out of money and had to move back in with my parents pretty quickly.
And did you have fears that you might find yourself living in that basement for the rest of your life?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was actually making plans for kind of a backup career. I was going to go to paramedic school. And, I was beginning to suspect that this goal, which I thought might take a few years, which is, getting a book published, might take 10 or 20 or something.
Did something click with American Rust? Did you suddenly understand things that you hadn't understood previously?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a very transformative six-month period, which I was living at home a few years after I'd left the bank. And I started asking myself all these questions about how does art actually affect an audience? How does literature affect an audience? And these were the things that led directly to – this was like the awakening or kind of I think it was like – this was my year zero, basically. So.
Well, there are big themes in this book, and there were in American Rust. Do you start off with thinking about those big themes? Or do they come along? Are they just things that you don't even think about, but reviewers suddenly say, well, there are all these big themes in Philip Meyer's book?
So the stuff, I would say most of the time I start out with like an image or a feeling. The good stuff really all comes from the subconscious. And sure, halfway, the Son took the new book took about 5 years to write. And American Rust took about three and change. And so, of course, halfway through, you're aware of what you're writing about. You're aware of these themes. You're certainly aware of them before anyone else reads the book. But it's not something that I would say the ideas or the sort of like intellectual sort of structures you have when you start a work are generally always wrong. They're always the worst ideas you're going to have.
Did this start with the idea of Eli McCullough, the first boy born into the newly established Republic of Texas?
It actually didn't. He was the last character, even though it seems like the book is structured around him. But this is a good example of my original conception of the book was to have these characters talking about the American creation myth and the settling of the West and these great heroes of our country who are essentially mythologized and not thought of as necessarily real human beings. And what happened was I realized that all I was doing was talking, and the characters were sort of speaking my opinions on this. And the book was failing miserably. This is about 2.5 years into it. And so I realized at that point I had to make Eli McCullough to actually do a bit of myth-making of my own so that the commentary would work alongside that.
And he is the stuff of myth. He's captured by Comanches when he's quite young and is brought up as a Comanche, adopted by the chief.
Sure. Yeah, so this is a very common experience on the frontier, not just in Texas, but even when the frontier was in Philadelphia or at the edge of New York back in, say, 1650, it was quite common for Anglo settlers to be taken by whatever Native American tribes' lands they were in the process of stealing. And sometimes, they would be killed. Sometimes they would be raised as Native Americans. But pretty much for the entire history of the settlement of this country, and even before it was a country, there was this constant sort of cycle of Indian captivities, they were called. So this actually was, you know, is now faded into legend, but it was quite common back in those days.
And over the course of his years with them, not that many, he learns how to build a bow, to raid settlements, to tan hides, to hunt buffalo. How much research did this require on your part?
Quite a lot. I read about 350 books, but most of that, the research you're talking about, came from a hands-on experience. So I taught myself to bow hunt. I never built my own bow, but I killed a couple of deer with a bow and, you know, ate their meat, tanned the hides. I also went to an organic sort of buffalo ranch that supplies meat for grocery stores, went out with a rancher, killed a couple buffalo with him that were, you know, going to be sent to stores.
But not with a bow and arrow.
No, with hunting rifles. Yeah, exactly. That probably would have been not entirely humane to the buffalo. And I ended up, as we were bleeding them, the Comanches and all the other Plains tribes, and basically a lot of folks who still live close to the land now, will drink blood sort of as an emergency measure if you can't get water or something like this. The Maasai still do this. As we're bleeding the animals, sort of blood's pouring onto the ground, I realized I actually had to see what it tasted like, so I filled up a coffee mug and drank a mug full of this warm blood, which was quite disgusting.
Wouldn't it be coagulating as you're drinking it?
It was. We're talking like a minute after the buffalo were killed, so it was quite. But absolutely, a few minutes later, it would coagulate, yeah.
Now, American Rust took place in Pennsylvania. Mm. Were you living there at the time?
No. My brother lived there for 10 years. One of my best friends grew up in the river valley that I'd set the book in. But no, I grew up in Baltimore, kind of a working class neighborhood, mill neighborhood.
But you did move to Texas when you were writing this book.
Absolutely.
That's part of the research.
Yeah.
Eli describes in great detail how the Comanches used nearly every part of the buffalo, and that was one of the part of your research. Did you and then the Indians are almost wiped out by smallpox. How many Comanches are survived today?
I guess so. There are about 15,000 today, and about 1,400 and change survived to go to the reservation. This is in 1876. There's a bit of a trickle into the reservation over about 10 years, but come 1876, you have, yeah.
So Eli then reenters Anglo society, but he's neither white nor Indian, and he has to find a place for himself.
Yeah. And yeah. What he finds is, and again, this is all based pretty closely on the historical like data was, which is that these people who came out of these Comanche captivities and other Native American captivities were completely lost. They'd probably seen their families butchered. They were uncomfortable in both white and Native American societies. A lot of them committed suicide. It was much harder for women, especially. And a lot of them at this time do what Eli did, which is they become, you know, Texas Rangers, or later on they became cowboys. They sort of went back to the land. They stayed away from cities.
But applying their Indian experiences.
Same skills. Absolutely. Yeah.
Although in Eli's case, he becomes a lot more ambitious and creates a ranching and oil dynasty.
Yeah, absolutely. And
rather ruthlessly. Do you see the ruthlessness as arising out of his experience with the Comanches?
I don't. I don't think the Comanches were any more vicious than, say, the Anglo settlers. I mean, the Comanches were at war, the Plains tribes were at war, and we don't like to think about this because it runs counter to our narrative of, you know, liberty and equality for all. But the fact is, you know, we were at war with all the Native American tribes until they all went to the reservation. So it maybe more comes from the time and the type of person he is. But it doesn't come from his time with the Native Americans specifically, I would say.
Well, in his case, his ambition is problematic. Do you think ambition has to be problematic?
No.
The kind of ambition he has.
I don't think it does, but I think that one of the things that gets ignored in history is that you know, if you live long enough and you make enough money, people will forget the sins of your past. And certainly, you look at the Carnegies and people like this who were pretty brutal toward the people they worked with, you know, certainly had their, in Carnegie's case, had many of his employees killed, you know, directly or indirectly. And now, you know, we sort of think of them as a great man. And that was one of the things I was trying to address.
Now, his son, Peter, is your only first person narrator, and he considers himself an outsider in the family. He's kind of the moral center of this novel, isn't he? But isn't his compassion seen as a weakness?
I mean, absolutely. By the people in his family, he's seen as a weak character, and he is a bit of a he's sort of the opposite of his father. He's very thoughtful, but he has a hard time taking action, and this has consequences for people in the book.
And he is the only person in the family to earn a college degree.
Yeah, exactly. And
that always ruins
ruins
anybody in a dynastic family, doesn't it?
Yeah, sure.
It does affect his relationship with his father.
Absolutely. To a certain extent, his father understands that he's different, but his father also sees that Peter is almost born at the wrong time, you know, that he was born 100 years too early and should have been born at a sort of more civilized, less bloody time.
My guest is Philip Meyer. His latest novel, The Sun, and can you explain the spelling of your name? It's Philip with not two L's like my brother, but two P's. Like a French person's name without the E at the end.
Exactly. So it's the old German spelling. My father's proud of his German heritage, and so they kept that spelling.
Texas is very segregated in Eli and Peter's stories, which are set in the middle 1800s to the 1900s. To what degree does ethnicity still play a part in Texas society?
It's huge. I mean, South Texas is very, very heavily Mexican-American, and there was an enormous amount of very overt racism, including a sort of massacre that took place in real life from 1915 to 18 that all of the Peters sections are based on. And when I moved to Texas and learned that several thousand Mexican-Americans had been killed by Anglo ranchers, Texas Rangers over the course of several years, and that I'd never heard of this incident, but this is sort of a known part of Texas history. That was the first incident that I knew would end up in the book.
Well, there's a woman, Maria, who's the only surviving member of a rival Mexican ranching family.
Exactly. Yep.
They've been slaughtered on Eli's orders.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was based on a number of historical events in which powerful Anglo ranchers got rid of their Mexican-American neighbors, who'd in fact been on the land, maybe 200 years longer.
To some degree, part of the story reminds me, not in its detail, of the great Howard Hawks film, Red River. Are you aware of that film?
I saw it midway through the research of the book, but it was sort of in this marathon of watching Westerns to make sure I wasn't sort of forgetting anything. Yeah.
Although the Westerns all mythologize, and it's obviously your intent to demythologize here.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially those early, the Westerns that we grew up watching, pre-Dances with Wolves, very much sort of portrayed this, the innocent Anglo settlers going to the wilderness, and they're attacked by these vicious Indians, in quotes.
Who are defending their own land.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, who have been under attack for 300 years.
Now, Jeannie, the third major character in this book, is the great-granddaughter of Eli. Did some of what you describe about her come out of your experience on Wall Street?
It did. And, of course, because I was surrounded by very type A business folks who were, the for them profit is the bottom line, and which is fine. But I think there can be a moral cost to that, and especially when you're so close to, in Jeannie's case, so close to your choices directly affecting people's lives or whether they live or die directly, and it's also based on a number of true to life sort of oil people in Texas.
Well, usually the third or fourth generation can go in either direction. Mm. People are driven, or they're the ones who just try to live off of the money.
And Jeannie's very aware that she is the last sort of great woman or great person of the family, and that the rest, all the people after her, are going to be soft.
Did you feel pressure when you began writing The Sun because of the incredibly positive response you got from American Rust? I mean, they always say the sophomore novel is really rough, and one of the things that a number of, because the book is only released today, so you haven't gotten the big reviews, but a number of pre-reviewers have said is that you've gone against the conventional wisdom and written a really even better, perhaps, second novel.
Let's hope. I try not to. So praise can be just as damaging artistically as criticism can.
Especially when you're being compared to Hemingway, Faulkner, and Steinbeck.
You can't pay attention to any of it. I mean, you really can't. You have to flush that from your mind, the same as you would flush, you know, an insult from your mind. You have to work to your own standards, because that's what got you there in the first place.
Are those the kinds of writers who have been the biggest influence on you?
Absolutely.
The classic American
writers? Yeah, the big modernists, sure. So into that list, I would add, you know, Virginia Woolf, who's amazing, and Eudora Welty.
In this case, well, you finished a second novel. Is it getting any easier?
This one was a difficult birth, to put it that way. I mean, the first novel was much easier. This one was much harder to write. I hope the third one will be easier. We'll
see. And I'm assuming have already started on the third one.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm not going to ask you what it's about.
It's a magic realism. It's very different, yeah.
Philip Meyer's second book, The Sun, which, as I mentioned, has already been called by Publishers Weekly the stuff of great American literature. Don't get a swelled head, Philip. It's published by Echo. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks. Appreciate it.